House Bill 5031. I don't think I have glasses, so it's lucky for me. I don't think we'll need them. And this is services for persons with developmental disabilities. We have quite a few people signed up, and I'm going to be calling some of you by panels, and everybody will have 2 minutes to speak, and the boss here will hold up a little thing when you have 30 seconds left. And so we appreciate you coming today, and we appreciate Eric. If you have anything to hand out, you can hand it to Gary.
Here.
And Eric, I'm sorry, I'm thinking next committee. And I'm sorry, Eric. Kind of sounded the same. And we would ask that if you have a handout, that you don't just read from it, but try to use your time to summarize it, because we will read it. We're pretty good. And I really can only speak for myself, but I will make sure everybody reads everything that they get. So we will start. I'm going to start with the one person I have, excuse me, who's very important, right in front of my face, Representative Betty Comp, because I know you're busy.
Thank you, Chair Gordley and Chair Boone. And I'm going to break the rules.
Okay.
You asked me not to read from my paper, but I'm going to, because the information is really important, and I will be no more than 3 minutes. I promise. So, but I will start in committee for the record. I'm Representative Betty Comp from House District 22. I am here to speak in support of Oregon's rehabilitation request for $60 million in general funds in order to increase the rates we pay for comprehensive services to people with developmental disabilities. We, as a body of legislators, had many years where we have not been able to devote funding to what we have here before us today, and it's critical that we stabilize this delivery service. We have relied on nonprofit organizations to piece together and do what they can to help fund people that cannot take care of themselves with developmental disabilities. The current co-chair's budget adds $16.9 million. I applaud them for that, but it's far short of the $60 million that is needed. The couple of things, and I'm sure you have other people testify to this, so I'll be very brief, that it's going to help. It's going to help increase wages to over $10 an hour, which could improve the turnover crisis and increases other payroll expenses enough to improve benefits. And it increases non-payroll costs enough to allow some reasonable management of facilities and functions. The problem I have with this agenda and this plan is that it does not start until May of 2008. That's a full 12 months from now, and it's just too late and too hard to continue to run the way we have been here. I am very familiar with nonprofits delivering comprehensive service throughout my district, in particular and throughout Oregon. I'm always impressed and with their steadfast commitment to the people they serve and the employees they're serving them. As a school administrator and teacher, I know the challenges of supporting and including all of our citizens who need special help. I know the talent, patience, dedication required of every staff that provides this loving help and professional service every day. I am worried about the increasing risk of nonprofit failures in my district. I am concerned for the people they care for. I know I don't need to convince you of that need. I'm here just to convey my sense of urgency and ask that additional funds be allocated to the earlier amount of $16.9 million. And just a real quick, brief story, because the urgency here is for people that have been doing their job for many years without much support. I have an uncle that was born with Down syndrome. Shortly after his birth, my grandmother died. And it has been people in these agencies that have kept my Uncle Billy alive and well. And he was predicted not to live past 25 years old and not to be able to function much in life. And I assure you, at my mom's 80th birthday last year, he was there. And he gives everybody a big hug and is a very outgoing gentleman. And it is the people that we're here today to support that it provided him when our family couldn't do that, a place to live and love. So with that, I urge you to see if we can't put some additional funds in here besides the $16.9 million. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Cohen? Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you, Chair Gordon and Chair Boone.
Representative Gelzer, would you like to come forward? Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Boone, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to address you here today. For the record, I am Representative Sarah Gelzer, and I represent House District 16, which includes Benton County, Corvallis, and Philomath. And though I am not elected to represent such a district, I also came to the legislature with a strong desire to advocate for people specifically with developmental disabilities who too often do not have a voice in our system. There are not high-paid lobbyists. There are not people wandering the halls on behalf of these individuals. And in fact, it's very difficult often for the families that need our help to come and to be here because of the needs that they are caring for. There are many issues that you're going to hear about today that are very important to me personally. They include provider wages. They include wage offsets, allowing people with developmental disabilities who work to keep a reasonable amount of the money that they earn every month. But what I want to talk to you in particular about today is supports to families who are caring for children with developmental disabilities and their need for supports enabled to keep their children at home rather than losing them and being forced into the situation of placing them in foster care or nursing homes. Today in Oregon, we have 60 children who are growing up in nursing homes. One of these children is living in a small room behind a plexiglass shield with air holes in it that's locked from the outside, and she's been in that room since 1998. I don't believe that this is an appropriate way to treat children with disabilities in the state of Oregon. We have other families who are able to keep their children at home. Unfortunately, that choice comes at great cost to their families. They choose to live under the poverty line so that they can maintain their children's access to Medicaid or to SSI supplementation. They have to consider every month whether to accept raises, whether to accept jobs, in order to keep their children at home. We shouldn't do this to families that live here in Oregon. We should not say to people that you must be poor and live in poverty and deprive all of your other children of opportunities just so that you can keep your children at home. We have other families who keep their children at home, and the consequence of that is that they never sleep. They rarely have an opportunity to eat themselves because they're providing 24-hour care to very beautiful children that need their constant support. And they are not eligible for any services from the state of Oregon, and they are waiting. And so these parents care for these children 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, without a break, and respite is very difficult to access. Many of you have joined with me in co-sponsoring two bills that I hope will get a formal hearing and work session before this committee, House Bill 2406 and House Bill 2407, which is the Welcome Home Package. House Bill 2406 is a Medicaid waiver, a model waiver, and this would allow children who are severely disabled, they would be medically involved children who require constant care and assistance, they use wheelchairs and often eat from feeding tubes, to be eligible for Medicaid waived services despite their family income. This would help some children come home from nursing homes and foster care to live with their families, and more importantly, it would prevent others from having to go into these placements. Many, many other states have this program. We do not, and we absolutely should. We currently spend about $13 million per biennium on 60 kids in nursing homes. We could, for about $9 million per biennium, serve 125 kids on these waivers in their family home. Lastly, House Bill 2407 that people are going to talk to you about, the Family Opportunity Act. Oregon would become the first state in the nation to do this. It allows families to pay a small premium to buy into the state Medicaid plan as a supplement to their private insurance. This helps them to access things like diapers, durable medical equipment, respite, and 20 hours a month of in-home care. This will help people not have to live in poverty. It will allow them to accept raises. The two pieces together will help hundreds and hundreds of kids stay at home for a very different price of $3 million in this biennium. It's an important program. These families deserve this help, and I hope that we can make that happen for them this biennium. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Gozer? Thank you very much. Okay, I see another person with a special pen, Senator Morris. We're asking people to somewhat limit their testimony so we can get everybody in, but everybody gets 2 minutes, and as a legislator, you can have three.
I'll be
because you're very important.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, colleagues. For the record, Frank Morris, State Senator, District 8, Albany and Corvallis. I appreciate the opportunity to come and lend another legislative voice to this issue, for this huge unmet need that we have to address a critical part of our population with about mental disability community. My concern rests with respect to the business side, and that's my background. And I would ask all of us to consider as legislators, if we had the kind of turnover in our legislative staff in session that these providers have, could we survive? And that's what we're asking them to do. This session wouldn't be ending on June 29th. It wouldn't end on December 29th. We could not function. And that's what we're asking people to do with the kinds of reimbursements that we're providing. The second issue has to do, and this is a broader issue for all of us on Ways and Means, and that has to do with how do you calculate the essential budget level for these independent providers. The way that we do it for our government, direct government programs where we have state employees is we factor in specifically COLAs, the other payroll expenses, and we add them up and we say it rolls up to 5 or 6% per biennium. How do we treat those who are independent providers much differently? And so what we do is we chronically widen the gap over time by underfunding and not recognizing the true expenses. And so it's an issue, it's one of relative compensation so that they can provide services in a dependable quality way. And the other has to do with how do you maintain that over time, and the way that we calculate essential budget level is not adequate to meet their needs. So that's what I wanted to share with you. Again, raise the issue of the small voices in our budget that don't have big, wide constituencies like many things do, but it is so critical that we address this population appropriately. Madam Chair, thank you. I appreciate this opportunity. Did I make it in 3 minutes?
You know, I think you did. Any questions for Senator Morse? Senator Bates. Wait just a second.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, could you make a comment about one of the concerns that I know you are very concerned about and are working on, and it's our basic problem of a revenue shortfall in the state. To raise wages to a reasonable level for those who work independently for the state as well as state employees, I believe requires a dramatic change in how we raise revenue. Could you give us a moment on that, please?
It would take more than 3 minutes, Madam Chair, Senator Bates.
You can answer it.
We have a fundamental problem in that we have greater demand than we have the ability to meet with the revenue structure we have. So the question is, how do you look at tax reform in a way that creates greater stability and greater adequacy without raising taxes at the same time? And that is possible. We do have before us in this body bill that's 2530, House Bill 2530, that in fact does that. It raises substantially more revenue to backfill critical needs like this development disability community at the same time that you have a net reduction in taxation for those that are paying taxes. So there are solutions to the problems that we're confronted with, but we've got to rise up and tackle this whole issue of comprehensive tax reform. It's essential. I don't see any way out of it. I don't think we're going to grow our way out of this what we call a structural budget gap. It won't happen. So how are we going to solve it? And thank you for, I believe that's the question you asked, Senator Bates.
Absolutely. Madam Chair, thank you. Thank you very much.
Quick follow-up, Madam Chair. Yes, very quick. And there will be hearings on House Bill 2530, Senator Morris.
We will have additional hearings. I understand from the Chair that we will have additional hearings on House Bill 2530. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, I'm going to call... Dr. Miller has come from Coos Bay in case you need to get back on the road. And Ralph Greener, Mary. There's a lot of names in this little tiny box. Thank you. Okay.
That's great.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Jerry Miller, Director of Star Hope in Coos Bay. We provide services to adults with developmental disabilities. We operate 4 group homes and a vocational educational program and vocational employment. And we also own the Oregon Connection, the House of Littlewood, which is the largest Littlewood factory in the state. And our adults with developmental disabilities works in that factory. I'm here representing 70 of our employees. And the graph that you have before you shows that the average wage of several employees is $10.30 an hour. And I have employees with 1 year of service or under, up to 22 some years of service. And if you look at the graph, the years of service is tremendous within Star of Hope. But their salary range is pretty much static, even with the cost of living that comes in and so forth. And so we have a tremendous amount of people at Star of Hope that provide a professional type service, but they're not getting a professional wage. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture report on 2002 to 2004, 11.9% of Oregon households struggled to meet their basic needs for food. In Coos County in 2005, one adult and one child family, they need to have a basic family budget of $13.53 an hour. Star Hope pays $10.30 an hour. We have a $3,000 deductible on their health insurance. So I'm urging you to support an increase in wages and in contract obligations as soon as possible. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Dr. Miller? Okay, thank you very much. Ralph and the AFSCME group.
Thank you.
I'm trusting you to know who's on this list because I can't quite see them. Thank you. Welcome, and Annie, if you can choose who goes first, and just be sure to identify yourself for the record, please.
My name is Josh Diatsis. I live in Portland, Oregon. I'm here today to tell you about the mentally ill and developmental disabled program I work with. I'm frontline staff in a group home. The people I work with are unable to direct most of their cares, shop, manage their money, take their medications, remember to take showers, and can hit, bite, scream at odd times, and other very disruptive behaviors that can be dangerous for staff. One of the largest problems we encounter is staff turnover. It's very difficult to keep experienced staff because of the low wages and challenging behaviors of our clients. The constant rotation of new staff is very disruptive for the entire living and working environment. This has a direct impact on the health and safety of the clients due to the stress of having new people in their lives at all times. We work on building trust and a positive relationship within the home, and having that in constant disarray is very upsetting. Another issue that I've experienced is the struggle to keep up our home and our vehicles. Our clients depend on our vehicles to be able to get to their doctor's appointments and just average everyday living. When we cannot afford to fix, it increases fix our vehicles and increases the stress level of the clients, and their inappropriate behavior increases, which is a domino effect in the home. Creates a strain on our clients as they become more nervous, and treatments are inconsistent when we have to take them to the emergency room. The health and safety of our clients is a top priority for our staff. Training and behavioral management and better wages will help maintain consistent staffing, a safer learning and living environment for our people dealing with mental illness and developmental disabilities. Thank you for letting me be here today.
Thank you.
My name is Mary Hall. I'm a direct care staff at Albert Unicur. My concern is getting health care coverage for not only the people we serve, but for us as well. We've had one person that took 2 years to get him into the hospital to have his teeth taken care of because he's nonverbal, and it took that long to find someone that would do the work. We finally had to pull his teeth, and he's a much happier person now. But he's lost the ability to chew his food, so now it has to be pureed for him. Another woman has a choking issue when she eats or swallows, and so she has to have thicket for her food. That's not covered by insurance any longer, so that comes out of her money that she gets out of the month. Sometimes those cost up to $35 a can. She goes through a can a week. So she's only got like $100 to spend for all her own supplies and stuff. And the other thing is our health care. Our costs is so outrageous that people will not go to the doctor because they can't afford the copayment and they can't afford to pay for the prescription. We had one woman that had to go to the hospital 3 times before she would let them admit her because she had pneumonia. She could not pay the $3,000 deductible, plus the co-payments, plus the percentage, because the doctor was not on their preferred provider list. So I'm just hoping that you could give us our company more help. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and Senators and Representatives, my name is Lynn Peterson, and I am the President of Local 3214 Albertina-Kerr. I also work providing direct care services to the people served at our agency that we work for. I'm here to talk because the low wages and really bad benefits are directly affect the people that we serve at Albertina-Kerr, because we have such high turnover that when the high turnover affects them, because sometimes it takes time to build a rapport and to get to know the people served, and sometimes people don't realize that. We have new people who come to work, and they may think that the people that we work with are non-responsive and don't seem to know what's going on. And sometimes it's just getting to know them well enough so that you know when they're in pain, because it is so subtle to know that they have to get to trust you. The gentleman that I worked with at Washington Street, to tell that he was in pain, you had to know the difference when he would be hitting on his helmet. You would need to know whether this was pain or whether he was having a bad day. That takes time. It takes time to be able to tell what they're communicating, and they communicate very clearly once you have the time to get to know them. The wages are not good enough. We're only 93 cents above. Most of our people make 93 cents above minimum wage. And it is challenging work. And I don't think people realize that it is skilled work. We have people who work with G-tubes, change dressings. We do things that CNAs do. There are some things we do that CNAs can't do. And why not?
I'm going to ask you to wrap it up.
Sorry. And so you guys can be the light at the end of that tunnel. I mean, we're really, really hoping that you're the light at the end of the tunnel. You can't fix it, but at least you could help us with just a little better pay, a pass-through for wages. The worst-case scenario is nothing happens, and minimum wage will take and catch up to us, and then we'll get wage increases. We'll get them whether you give increases to them.
Thank you.
But thank you for letting me speak.
Any questions for this panel? Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Sorry. Is this your complete panel?
Yeah.
Ralph, are you speaking?
I'll let you finish. I'll close Ralph Groner with that. May it close the governor, put in his budget $12 million. You put the co-chairs, I think it's 4-9. Quite frankly, we've fallen so far behind in this, in the private sector, the deal with MRDD, that our turnover is atrocious. I've turned in testimony. I won't testify about it. You have a crisis, a very significant crisis statewide, and we simply have to find a wherewithal to increase the resources for salaries, for health benefits. $3,000 deductible really means when my members are talking to you, they aren't getting health care. They go to a hospital, they're turned down. They can't get the health plan because at $10 an hour, they were too high. In the end, all I want to say on behalf of my members and the wonderful people who work in this business, that they deserve a lot better than not being able to insure their children. Mm-hmm. And we have, I hope, can find the will and the dollars to make that happen. Thank you.
Thank you for trying. Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ralph?
Ralph, you need to come back.
Has there been an analysis done to see if wages were raised high enough to significantly decrease the turnover rate, if the funding, if you can gain enough from that funding to justify the wage? I mean, the turnover has got to be costing a lot of money to lose people and retrain people. So has there been an analysis done of where that wage needs to go to stop the turnover and how much you gain in not losing money for retraining and training?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bates there has, and as a matter of fact, the Small Voices has a full book that will outline what it costs in the retraining as compared to being able to keep people on a steady basis on the job. So Jan Crawl has that and can present that to you, and she's coming up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to call Miriam Cole, who's come from Ashland.
Hey.
Welcome. Thanks for coming all the way.
I'm here in support of 2406 and 2407. My name is Mary Ellen Cole, and my son is the Taylor Cole. My family has no financial or service gain from either of these bills. I happen to be returning a wheelchair that my insurance company declined covering, so I called the president of the insurance company, got a demo for my son, and had to return it to Portland and timed it so that I could be here today. So we're the poster family for how a family living with a disability is can be rendered broke pretty quickly, and we get assistance. The reason why I wouldn't benefit from these bills is because we adopted our son. We were foster parents, so we already are on OMAP, and we get the 20 hours DD services each month because of his disability. He recently had a dislocated kneecap. Very odd thing for a kid who's non-ambulatory and in a power wheelchair. So just last year, our IRS non-covered medical expenses were $7,000. And my husband is a rural community college teacher. He probably nets about $37,000. That's about a quarter of our operating income as a family just to get back and forth to the doctor for this surgery that rendered my son, who already has hydrocephalus and cerebral palsy, even more disabled and really needed addressing. I'm a stay-at-home mom, and someone has to be, or it's best if they can be, and so I just put that in too. When I talk about my medical expenses, I say strictly because when you have a handicapped child, you just need to know that the arc of expenses is completely inverted from that of your peers. I now spend more money per hour, over $10 an hour, and as my son gets larger, he's 11 years old, he's almost 120 pounds, more money is spent on child care now than when he was a preschooler, and four more dollars per hour. And, I have so many great things to say.
I'm going to have you wrap it up here.
Okay. So my understanding of this bill is that the feds would give us money 2-1, just like adoption assistance. And I would just urge you to think about how many families might not be able to adopt children in this state if the feds didn't do the 2-1 match, and how that might really benefit our state and our kids by using that 2-1 match and getting more money for our kids. And
Thank you. And I'm sure you meant to say you were testifying on House Bill 5031. So that's what this hearing is. So.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Sorry. So thank you. Is there any questions for Ms. Cole? Dr. Bates.
Thank you. Just want to thank you for coming up from Ashland. Appreciate your testimony.
Yeah.
And I wish I had a few minutes to chat with you, but I have to stay here.
Yeah.
Thanks. Have a good trip back.
Okay, thanks.
Yes, thank you for coming. That's a long way. Okay, I'm going to bring up a panel of four: Catherine Wright, Sabrina Hilden, Joey Piazzano, Kathy Drew. Apologize if I butchered any names here. I'm doing this without glasses. Welcome,
Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'll begin and then I'll just step away to allow others to speak. My name is Catherine White, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Coalition. I just wanted to set the context for a series of panels that you're going to see today in which we hope to hit the highlights of what we believe are some of the most significant issues. As you know, the DD system has gone through major change since the mid-80s, moving from an institutional custodial care approach to community-based services and a change in philosophy to self-determination and empowerment of families. This has been a major revolutionary change. In the meantime, we have also struggled to recover from the many things that happened to the DD system during the budget reductions. And those things included such things as the 50% reduction and loss that's never been restored to family support services. At the request of the state, we renegotiated the Staley settlement, which meant that people were going to have to wait for entitled services another 4 years. Our provider infrastructure is collapsing just at the time we're getting individuals with more significant needs coming into the system. And our system is becoming more complex. We're getting baby boomers who want different kinds of services. Our county case management system is experiencing caseloads of 1 to 100. And we're dealing with families who are forced to deliberately impoverish themselves in order to get access to support. The advocates in the state have worked together for many, many years, collaboratively and creatively to address the needs in the system. The Fairview closure, the Staley settlement, budget committees, work groups to try and be creative. But we actually have reached that point where creativity and collaboration is no longer the way to solve our problems. We've compromised, we've made deals, and we can't continue. We simply cannot continue. As a DD coalition today, what we have done is prioritized issues that we believe are achievable during this legislative session. And so you're going to be hearing those issues that we have prioritized: provider wages, children living in their family homes, and some employment issues. So those are the panels you'll hear today from us.
Thank you, Catherine.
Am I next?
Yes. Hi, thank you for having us today. My name is Joey Rosano, mother of Jade Rosano, this beautiful little girl back here. And I thank you for your thoughtful consideration for listening to us today. I'm also one of the poster children for the families that are dealing with disabilities. Both bills, all of these bills are so important not only to the livability of Oregon as a community, which embraces all of its population, not just the ones who can walk and talk and feed themselves. My daughter has Rett syndrome, which is a neurological developmental disorder, which is caused by a random genetic mutation on the X chromosome. A big surprise to us, and she was diagnosed 2 years ago. I was a highly employed at the time analyst for a semiconductor industry when my water broke at 27 weeks, and then we were dealing with this.
What I found in the disability community is that families dealing with disabilities are tapped out emotionally, spiritually, and financially, and I'm dealing with that as well. They're already dealing with a tremendous amount of stress, grief, and strain, and then they have therapies, medications, equipment, respite, feeding tubes, surgeries, wheelchairs, even with private insurance. These things cost a lot of money. If you don't qualify for SSI, then you basically, as a family, you have to choose between poverty or bankruptcy and foster care. My duty caseworker, when we decided to try to change the laws in Oregon because nothing was available, I said, what can I do to get services for my daughter? And she said, well, you can give her up for adoption, and then she would qualify for everything. I don't think adoption should be an option for me. So what can I say in 30 seconds? Keeping Jade in our home means more than words can express. We have a saying in our home that when Jade is happy, everyone's happy. Thank you for your thoughtful consideration.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Hi, my name's Sabrina Peden. This is my daughter, Alyssa. When Alyssa was born, she did not breathe on her own for 33 minutes. She suffered severe brain damage and was diagnosed with cerebral palsy when she was about 2 months old. I cry every time, I'm sorry. Alyssa's dependent on me for every need that she has, from dressing and diapering to feeding and moving, everything she needs. I've made many sacrifices as a parent, as most parents do for their children, but my sacrifices have been a little different. The biggest one I've made is having to put off marrying Willie, who is the man I've been with for almost 8 years and who I have a son with. Because if we were to get married, we would barely exceed the amount allowed to receive Alyssa's SSI Medicaid, which pays for so much of her needs, including medications that average over $750 a month, her diapers, her tube feeding supplies, special formula, and durable medical equipment like her wheelchair and hospital bed, just as a few things. We would not be able to provide for our family and still keep Alyssa in our home. And as been mentioned, we have been told that we could put Alyssa in a special home or make her a foster child, but to me, keeping my family together is absolutely the most important. Another sacrifice that I've made that I've been faced with is whether it will be worth me working when I finish school. It's been my dream for a very long time to be a registered nurse. I'm working very hard right now to make this dream come true, but in reality, I will probably be working almost completely to cover Alyssa's needs. So, in closing, when I first heard about this bill, I actually jumped up and down in excitement, thinking that for the first time in a very long time, I could picture myself working as a nurse, plan a wedding, which has been wonderful, and would be wonderful, and keep my family together and make it complete.
Thank you very much. I hear you. Someone wants that? Question? Anybody? Somebody?
Yeah, just a comment. I mean, this reminds me of a discussion we had a few weeks ago relative to foster care, where essentially if you get a divorce, give a child up, the state gives you a much higher benefit than if you step forward as a loving parent to take care of your child. It's a perverse system, one we have to change. This is ridiculous. I can see two women sitting in front of me who are both thinking, if I get a divorce and impoverish myself but stay with my husband and my other children, then I get benefits. But if I do the right thing and don't do that, I'm penalized for it.
Thank you for recognizing that.
It's just insane. It's just insane.
Thank you very much. And keep the faith.
Stay in school.
I'm Kathy Drew. I'm from Deschutes County, and I'm the program manager for the Developmental Disabilities Program in the county. This is a job that I've done with great love for over 30 years, and I think that's important because those 30 years have given me some wrinkles, some wonderful memories, and a really, I think, good perspective, having watched generations now of children be born and grow up to adults with their developmental disabilities. And one thing I would really have to say is that how well a family does in raising their child with a developmental disability often depends less on the severity of that disability and more on the resiliency of the family, the strengths that the family has. Family support is a program that can help build on that resiliency. They can be there to listen to people. They can be there to laud them for the incredible job that they do. And they can be there to help them get little bits of respite from a job way too hard to expect anyone to do. They can also help people, help families access the equipment and the technology that enhances the quality of their child's life. These people do a job, and you can all hear it and know it, but they do a job that would cost us hundreds, thousands of dollars if it were being done in any foster home or in any other setting. And they do it with love. They do it with determination, a sense of humor. It's sometimes it's just with a grace that absolutely astonishes me that people continue to do this, and they do the very best job of it. We have some wonderful programs that provide great service. Nobody provides the service that these families do, and they provide it at virtually no cost. So we must be able to provide them a little bit of support to go on saving us lots of money and doing the right thing by keeping children at home with their families. Because as somebody said one time when they were getting ready to place a child outside their home, you know, this might be the last night this child ever lives in a home where they're truly loved. We can't let that happen. We have to let those children stay at home with the families who love them. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thanks very much. I'll call the next panel up while you're shifting here. Tim Rosick, Norm Keller, Brian DeLashmit, and Andy Heldington. I'll say, I first heard about this need, what was it, a year ago, Jan, maybe, when you came to me with this, and we had a meeting here in the Capitol, and it was an eye-opener, and I truly appreciate your input at that time to, I mean, I know things were bad out there, but I had no idea. And it's nice seeing it all come to fruition here. So, there's a fourth chair, Brian, over at this little table, if you want to all come up together. I know I messed up on your name. It's not a Swedish name, so how could I know? So, when you're ready, please introduce yourself. And
my name is Cindy Ellington.
Cindy, I'm sorry, I called you Andy. I'm sorry. And I have my glasses, I'm sorry.
That's
Cindy,
okay.
Welcome.
I'm the executive director for South Advocates and Leaders, and I'm the former president of People First. Now I live in Springfield, Oregon. I'm here to testify on the offsets bill and all the other tools that I know that I've put out 2 minutes. And I want to talk about the offset.
We're hearing House Bill 5031. And Brian, you're here.
2464 is a major portion of a lot of discussion today. That's what she's talking about.
Okay. I just want to advise you, we do not have these bills in front of us, though, just so you know. Thank you.
Well, people with disabilities, even when they're living in the group homes, they don't get to do any work. They can't get, they have to pay part of their paychecks to pay for their supports and stuff, and that's not enough for paying for you know, the personal items or going to movies or anything. And I'm going to try to make this short, but everybody, someone else can go fast down. Get done. I believe in children at home. I believe in increase on the pay for the supports people with disabilities needs to live their daily lives. And thanks for listening to me.
I'm going to grab a little bit of Cindy's time.
Okay, thanks
very much. I apologize a little bit for the change of pace here. I've come to testify on House Bill 2464. That's what Cindy's talking about. I didn't know that prior to her coming up. My name is Norm Kohler. It's on the letterhead. I've given you one page. It's my 2 minutes, if you're a reasonably fast reader. And what I tried to do in that one page is summarize what the offset bill is all about, so you can see the issue clearly. And I'm going to read a little bit of that, just in keeping it to our 2 minutes, or 2.5 minutes now. I've been the executive director of Community Access Services for the last 19 years. This is a private agency that operates programs in Washington, Multnomah, Clackamas, and Columbia counties. I certainly support the issues of the wage increase, which is absolutely crucial. And I want to tie this in a little bit of what we mean by offsets. Offset is essentially a payback that's required of certain people who are subject to offset payments, and I'm concentrating, of course, in my business on people with developmental disabilities. 2 years ago, an offset bill unanimously passed the Oregon House, died in committee in the Senate as the session ended. And I think this is probably my fourth legislature coming to testify on an offset bill. We bring this offset bill back time and time again, because the current regulations governing workers with developmental disabilities who are subject to an offset, that is this payback of their wages to the state, it's shameful and it is an outrage. And I think this is what Cindy was trying to say. The present requirement in Oregon is that a person receiving state services who is subject to the offset must pay back to the state dollar for dollar everything they earn in a month above $65, and in addition, out of that $65, they pay the total Medicaid and Social Security tax on the entire amount of their earnings, including the offset that they pay back. So I have an example here that I'm going to skip to. So one of my clients in Washington County, who in the year 2003...
Actually, you have 2 minutes.
Okay.
I'm sorry. It goes quickly, I know. But we do have the testimony written. So.
To summarize, we have long discouraged people from working. It's gotten worse over time because the $65 was set years and years ago. Every increase in the minimum wage has been a decrease for workers subject to the offset. And it's far past time that this be changed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Morrison.
Where is this bill right now?
It's in your possession, Ways and Means possession.
But we're not dealing with it.
No, this is a little confusing to me because when I came into the room, we're hearing House Bill 5031, and we're hearing several other.
Thank you very much for calling my attention.
Being a little flexible.
And I appreciate that. No, we will certainly take a look at that.
Just one, thank you, Madam Chair. Just one quick question. I know it's kind of confusing, but we had testimony on this earlier in the week, and we'll be looking at it again, obviously. And I appreciate you coming and talking to us about it. If we took the $65 from 20 years ago and brought forth on an inflationary basis, where would that number be now?
I can answer that question when I get my opportunity.
Okay, we'll hold it till then. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tim Rochuk. I'm Executive Director of Garten Services, a Salem-based not-for-profit that provides employment and training to about 500 people with disabilities from Salem to Eugene and points in between. I'm here to talk about the DD Comprehensive Services budget. You have testimony. I will not go through every single point, but I want to call your attention to a few points. First off, I want to thank those of you who have been supportive of services to people with disabilities in the past. These services help Oregonians with disabilities live fuller, richer, more contributing lives. I have the pleasure to see people with disabilities, the joy and the exuberance when sometimes they earn their first paycheck. Never have you seen people happier to be taxpayers. I've worked in the field in Oregon for about 25 years, and I've never seen us in a tougher situation to provide services. It's always hard to pull together enough resources, but it's never been harder than it is today. There's lots of reasons for that, and they're detailed in the handouts that you have. I won't cover them. In short, minimum wage has been increased, and our rates haven't, and they haven't kept pace. And then there are other, of course, inflationary pressures. My organization and other service providers around the state have participated in the downsizing of Fairview and ultimately the closure of Fairview. And we did that because it was the right thing to do, but we also did it with the understanding that there would be support for community-based programs to help people with disabilities who left Fairview. We've saved the state millions of dollars, literally, each year, and we're looking for that support to continue. The support that we've gained in funding from the legislature has not kept pace. And I want to just cover the point that Catherine made. We've done our part. We've innovated. We've gotten more efficient. We've combined with other programs to gain economies of scale. We've done fundraising. We've developed entrepreneurial businesses as ways to supplement our funding. We need you to help us at this point. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
For the record, I'm Brian DeLeishman. I'm here representing the Community Providers Association of Oregon. You actually have written testimony. It's from Sheila Barker, who was ill at the last minute, and I'm substituting. I'm one of those high-paid lobbyists that Representative Gelser said is not in the building advocating for these folks. I don't know about high-paid, but there is folks in this building that care very much about this issue. Let me just summarize 2 points of Sheila's testimony. One of the points is, again, you've heard about wages. If you would turn to the chart on her testimony, this is just within her agency in Spruce Villa. It talks about the other programs that these employees are eligible for, including food stamps. This shows the level of inadequate pay that we have for the employees and the added cost actually to the state and the federal government by us not paying these folks right in the first place. These people are eligible for state and federal programs for assistance. That's absolutely unacceptable. The second piece that has been touched upon is the offsets piece. I've been working with Norm and others for a couple of sessions. Actually, Chair Boone, you carried this bill on the House floor last time. It passed unanimously out of committee, passed on the floor last time, and got caught at the end of the session. What we're in essence asking for is the offsets level of $65, which has been in for 20 years or more, to be brought up. This bill, in answer to Senator Bates' question, where would it be today? I think that's what the current version of 2464 does. It really indexes it to one quarter of the eligible Social Security level of income, and so it would be around $320 to $330. This is achievable. We've checked, had the agency check with CMS back in Baltimore whether or not they would look favorably upon an amendment to the federal waiver in this area. The response that we are aware of, they got back is yes, this is doable. It's a minimal amount of dollars. It's a 60-40 federal dollars to state dollars for any lost dollars to the state that they wouldn't get being paid for the dollars over $65, and announced about $400,000. And we would very much like to get that bill out this session.
$400,000, did you say?
Roughly $400,000 of the total cost of loss of a little over $1 million. But I think you also need to take into account when you have these people earning additional dollars, they're paying taxes too. There are other intangibles, so forth. So I don't think you can just look at it just purely economics, but the division's estimate of the actual cost of that's about $400,000.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Questions for this panel? Okay, thanks very much. The next panel will call up Jan Staley, Governor Helena Jackson, Michelle Lehman, Jean Farr, and Jim Bridge. So, Jan Staley? It says Carl Staley?
No, Jan Fall, Michelle Lehman.
Yeah. They're crossed out and then they're back there.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. You're on two different sheets. That's the problem. We will take these four. If you'll let me know who you are, then we'll make sure we'll catch up here. I'm sorry. It was a little confusing on the sheets, too.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the community. My name is Jean Farr,
and I work at Albertina Care Centers, a 100-year-old human services organization. I'm also aunt and sister of Oregonians with disabilities, and I'm going to make a few brief points reinforcing what some of my colleagues have said earlier, and then introduce you to my panel, which consists of other members of the CUR community. And we are all here asking for your support in the Oregon Rehabilitation Association's funding request. Senator Morse earlier talked about business viability. I know currently of four organizations serving people with developmental disabilities that are in the process of dissolution right now, today. And this is not an unusual circumstance. Over these last couple of years, this has become increasingly common. Two of the things mentioned earlier in terms of the human toll of this crisis were healthcare and turnover. To give you a little more detail about that, at CUR, we employ about 700 people. 500 of those have healthcare. Only 20 of those 500 people can afford to insure their spouses. Only 17 of those 500 can afford to insure their children, and only 2 can afford family coverage, just to give you a sense. So it's extremely disturbing to know that we're working within a community where we can't provide adequate health care for families. Another significant issue is staff turnover. Most of the employees that we hire are gone within the first year, and as you can all imagine, the cost of that on the people supported is staggering. I mean, it takes a while for somebody to learn to trust somebody, to work with them and care for them in the most intimate of ways. And once they develop that trust, their caregivers, you know, move on for a higher paying job, leaving them to deal with yet another stranger coming in the middle of the night, repositioning them, administering their medicine. I mean, it's absolutely, absolutely unacceptable. As the cost of services...
Summarize it, please. Sure, yeah. 2 minutes, thank you.
Bottom line is our system's begun to crumble, and we're at the breaking point. I realize you have tough decisions to make, but when you're deciding and thinking and talking about the issues that you're going to be making decisions upon, please think of us, remember us, think of these people in this room. With that, I will introduce you to Lavinia Jackson. She has been an employee of Albertina Care Centers for 20 years. She testified before you a couple years ago, and she has brief testimony for you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Chair Boone, members of the community, my name is Lavinia Jackson. I work as a Life Richmond Specialist at CUR Development Disability Service. I work in a group home in Southeast Portland that serves 5 adults with developed disability. I live in your district, Senator Carter, and resident Colton. I am a mother who is very dedicated to her family. I am very active in my community. I am active in the Title I District Parentee Advisory Committee for the Portland Public Schools. I volunteer with the Site Council Committee, which meets one time a month. I help with the Housing Authority of Portland resident counseling meetings. I volunteer at Rosa Park Elementary School, where I help with art, dance, and classroom assistant. I worked in my job at CUR for 20 years. Some of the things my work includes are personal care, preparing food, giving medication, community activities, scheduling and planning appointments, celebrations, and more. What I love most about my work is that I and other workers work for sure quality care, independence, and abilities for people we serve to make choices and advocate for their rights. I love most of all the achievements that people serve, accomplish, and the smile that comes with the care, understanding, and dedication of all our staff. I testified before this committee 2 years ago, and I am here to tell you that things have not gotten better for my family. The wages I earn are not efficient enough to support myself, my family. I am here today to let you know what I have to do to be able to remain working in this job. I work a second job working for Portland Public Schools at Rosa Park Elementary, working 10 hours a week on my days off. I work Tuesday through Thursday.
I'm not asking you to
wrap it up a little.
I work Tuesday through Friday.
Thank you.
My second job, I check on students with high attendance and absences, and I really love working for Albertina Kerr, and my dedication in the company for many years has let it be known that the wages increase has not.
Okay.
So, and my fellow staff members are kind of having the same problems I'm having with gas increase, bus fare, additional family members. So we're
Thank you. I guess it's a good time to remind that everybody else whose phones have not gone off to please turn them off. Thank you.
We don't want to blame Jan Carl, so we'll blame Ann Heim, the person sitting next to Jan. That's whose phone really went off.
I'd like to introduce you to Jim Bridge. He and his wife, Molly, are here with their son, Peter, who lives in one of our homes in Eugene.
Thank you. Welcome.
Chair Boone and members of the committee. I'm going to read my statement in an effort to beat the 30-second clock. Our son Peter is currently living in a community-based group home managed by Albertina Kerr Center. He lives in your district, Representative Nathanson. He is considered medically fragile and totally dependent on his caregivers for all of his needs. He does not communicate verbally, must be fed, given medicine, and have all of his other needs attended by his caregivers. In June of 1974, at age 5, we took Peter to Fairview State Training School. He was there until January of 1999, when the state was closing Fairview and all the residents were placed in other facilities. During his stay there, we saw many positive changes, and we were happy with his care. We resisted the closure of Fairview, and because of this, Peter was among the last residents placed in the community. One of the reasons we were worried about community placement was the importance of having staff that was long-term, consistent, and trained to work with the population. Most of that staff that worked with Peter were there when he arrived and were there when Fairview closed. We've done our research and we're aware that the turnover of staff in group homes was very high, the biggest reason being the wage and benefit packages. As you can well imagine, this is not easy work. It is physically and mentally challenging. The caregivers are responsible for giving medication, feeding people that have special dietary needs, lifting, bathing, transporting, and all other needs. In other words, they require life-saving skills. They must be well-trained and monitored. Many of the caregivers have to have two jobs in order to survive.
We're at 2 minutes.
They seem to have a great sense of responsibility. We feel that a cost of living raise is essential. Decent wages equal good staff. These people are not flipping hamburgers, and they are quality of life support staff for a population that cannot survive without them. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Our final member of this panel is Jan Staley. She is a member of the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Council and the chair of the self-advocate subcommittee of that council. Welcome, Jan.
Can you hear me okay?
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, hello, I am Jan Staley. I am here to advocate for the ED provider rate increase. I am scared.
Don't be scared.
Let me tell you why. I live in a supported living situation, receiving support in my own apartment. I am currently working for a new personal assistant or a caregiver, as most people would understand. People are not running to take that job. If I don't hire a caregiver soon, the agency which provides me the services that makes it possible that they have a qualified caregiver will be forced to drop me from their program due to costs that they can no longer support. I have no idea what my life would look like if that should happen. I have woken up to nightmares of glimpses of how badly my life could be turned around. I wish that Joseph, you could spend a week in my life. Then, I am sure you would get the most emotional roller coaster ride of your life. Most people know that at any given time, they are 5 minutes away from a life or an accident. Pretend an hour of one now, you are on your way home, and suddenly a car slams down into you. After an extensive stay in the hospital, you are finally released. You are only 40% recovered. You are keenly aware that you will need help with personal care. Can you imagine the quality of care you would expect to have? When I was 21, my mom was in that head-on car crash. A year later, I moved from my family home to a group home run by Albertina Care Centers. I eventually moved into an apartment, which has given me room to find my independence. In the 18 years I have been with CURE, I have seen a lot of good, decent personal assistants come and go. Most of these people treated this job as a stepladder. It feels, in times of desperation, anyone is vital with your blood. Many do not make it past the training period because they have found less demanding jobs paying more than $8.77 an hour. Please, we need more money to help keep caregivers on the job. When our caregivers receive the wages that they deserve, I and other people like me will have a better quality of life. In the long run, it will save the state money because the funding will directly enhance my life rather than wasting it on my turnover. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for your story.
Representative, Chair Boone, Jan's story reinforces what organizations like ours are having to face. The idea of us having to give notice on somebody we've supported for 18 years, that's what we're looking at.
Madam Chair, I have a question. Senator Gordon, you indicated in your earlier testimony that there are 4 organizations going through dissolution.
Uh-huh.
What are those organizations? Where are they located?
Several of them are located in Multnomah County and one in Washington County. And if you don't mind, I'd rather talk to you about that privately.
That's fine.
And I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you so much.
Later today,
deeply concerned about that we're losing capacity.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
And we have a couple more questions, I think, Senator.
First of all, just a comment. Jan was at our, as many of us will remember, at our Full Ways and Means Committee hearing in Clackamas, and you did the same excellent job there that you did here today. Thank you so very much for being here.
Other questions? Ms. Payne?
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to call the next panel. Now we have Jan Kral, Michelle Lehman, Deborah Taylor, and Shirley Coburn.
Chair, members of the committee,
I'd like to introduce Shirley Coburn, Deb Taylor, and Michelle Lehman, who will give their testimony, and then I'll click follow after they do. Michelle, do you want to begin?
My name is Michelle Lehman, and I live in South Salem at Pinewood Terrace, and I used to be a member of People's First. I work at Chemeketa Community College in the kitchen. I was a dishwasher, and I bus tables and check to make sure things are stocked and swept and the whole thing. Lots of things. People were already being nice to me most of the time, but when people are mad and upset, when I am kind of upset,
just tell your story, Michelle.
Although people are very friendly, most staff are there and very outstanding and help me a lot. When staff leaves, it makes me feel stressed out and sad because they know me and they know how I like things done. It also kind of feels like I am losing a friend that takes me a few weeks to
I'm going to have you wrap us a little bit. Can you just tell me how it feels, how many staff you've had to hire?
We had 6 or 7 staff out at Chemeketa and had 8 or 9 staff where I moved to now. And the staff that was working there before, a lot of them I got along with, and some of them I didn't because I wasn't used to them like I am now, because I have a good supervisor now and a good boss, and I've learned so much from both of them that what they've taught me, I actually learned a lot better, because I always follow what they tell me to do, and I always get compliments and nice things said about me, about my work, and how well I do it when I'm there on time, and I show up early sometimes, because Kim's not there a lot, so I always, take over for her a lot, and then I
thank you. Thanks very much.
Am I done now?
Yeah.
Well, we need a little bit of time.
I know it's not very much time, and
it's okay.
Probably not enough time to tell what you need to tell, but we do have your written testimony, so that's good. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, good afternoon. My name's Deb Taylor and I work for Shangri-La. I've worked for the Shangri-La Corporation for 7 years now. The first 6 years I was a housing staff. Now I've moved on to vocational. I'm representing custom packaging and manufacturing, where 40 of our individuals come to work every day of the week. I chose to be a part of Shangri-La. The community we serve, who are adults with severe mental and physical disabilities, out of a desire to do something positive, to make a difference in a person's quality of life, and to give back and share some of the skills that I'd learned during my years of growing. This came from the heart. not for the pay. During the past 7 years, I can't begin to count how many coworkers I've helped train, only to see them move on to different positions because they couldn't live on the wages they were making with us. Staffing turnover boils down to wages. We all know how the cost of living has gone up over the past 5 to 10 years. Look at the cost of gasoline, just as one item. But our wages have not gone up. New staff start out at $1 over minimum wage, which is not a living wage, but they are expected to support their families and pay the bills on the amount of money they try to make ends meet, but most of them just can't do it, and within a year's time, they've moved on to better paying jobs. They love their jobs, but they love their families too. The community we serve are very routine-oriented individuals. Many of them depend solely on their staff for support with the basic day-to-day needs that you and I take for granted, such as preparing meals, doing laundry, showering, shaving, brushing your teeth. Without the staff, they can't get it done. Excuse me. They do not like change in their lives. The high rate of staff turnover greatly affects their lives, and not in a very healthy, happy, or productive manner. I feel that if staff were paid a decent living wage, along with medical benefits, as are the state employees that do the same type of work that we do, turnover would slow down, routine would be maintained, and the community we serve would be a happier, healthier, and more productive group to be around. This would benefit all. Thank you for taking the time today to hear our side of the story.
Excuse me for interrupting your last sentence. Thanks very much.
Yes.
Good afternoon. Thank you for being here to hear us. My name is Shirley Colburn. I have a brother named Paul. Hi, Paul. He came to live with me after our mom passed away. I always knew that he was going to be with me, but I never thought I would be disabled and unable to care for Paul. When he lived with my mom, his world was TV land, Channel 64. He stayed in his room. He ate all of his meals in his room. Mom did everything she could. She was 85. When an actor would pass away, Paul would call me crying and telling me that so-and-so passed away, his friend. Those were his friends. Now he's been up here in group homes for a year and a half. The first group home wasn't a very good group home, but now he's from Shangri-La. He's seen a lot of changes. He's more vocal. He goes to work every day. He will not miss a day's work. He won't even come to see me if he has to miss a day's work. The changes that he goes through are very traumatic to him. These people that take care of our loved ones are special individuals. Not everyone in the world can do these jobs. It takes a very special person with a big heart to do this job. And they need a wage that they can raise their families on. They could probably all go get a couple jobs at McDonald's and make it, but yeah, I saw the 30-second sign lost it. Okay. Every one of us at some time in our lives are going to need someone to take care of us or someone in our family that we cannot take care of. We need to keep these special people. We need to give them what they earn and what they deserve to keep them taking care of our loved ones. Where would they be? Where would we be without them? Thank you.
Thanks very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you. I have to say, Paul, you look a little like Mel Gibson. Does anybody tell you that?
Nice. I have a chair.
It's true. A little shorter hair, but you know. Welcome, Jan.
Thank you. Chair Boone, members of the committee, I am Jan Krall. I'm the CEO of the Shangri-La Corporation, but today I'm representing the Oregon Rehabilitation Association, which represents 100 or more programs serving over 7,500 people with disabilities in our state. I'm here to support the OIR recommendation for comprehensive funding. I want to thank each of you for your attention and advice and compassion throughout the interim and the session as we have learned how to find our voice and tell you about this issue. Today, I would like to add evidence-based information to your already deep understanding of Oregon's DD comprehensive funding issue, and I hope this information will move you to increase the co-chair's budget. There's clear consensus that the compensation-related turnover is the single greatest issue destabilizing the DD compensation system. Two studies demonstrate that increased compensation will remediate the problem, and one of them was in California, with wage increases to $12 an hour, reduced turnover from 61% to 26%, and in Wyoming, turnover was reduced nearly 40% when funding was increased by 34%. I've attached the reports in your testimony so that you can peruse them, but I'd just like to emphasize that these examples support the forecasts so that we've made. They validate our experience, and they demonstrate that we will experience remediation of our turnover once we do increase wages. Next, I wanted to address with you that I know you've heard many occasions the story within the story. You've heard about and met many of the over 7,000 employees who are the heart's blood of our community system. They're among the poorest of the working poor, and currently our employees access many state-funded benefits. I'd like to point out to you some estimated financial outcomes that $60 million in general fund to the DD compensation could provide. I know that I'm going over my time, but if you
wish. Yeah, and I just have to remind you, we still have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 people to tell.
Okay, well, so in your testimony, there's evidence I would like to point out that by investing the $60 million, there's the potential for reductions in Oregon subsidy programs, increases in state taxes collected from duty workers, and additional revenue from federal match of $99,842,000. And so I think that it's worthy of a conversation to look at the associated savings and benefits that might be there. Additionally, I've attached a chart.
I'm going to have to ask you to wrap it up, Jen. I'm sorry. We've got just such a few minutes
left. Come and see all of you with it.
Yes. Okay. Well, thank you.
You didn't tell us who was calling her either. I mean, that's what we really want.
I really apologize. It's just never long enough.
Okay.
So we have the information in the handouts.
Yes,
okay. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to call up now James Smith and Gordon Ferrock-Teifel.
Yeah.
Okay. And Robin and Aaron Thompson.
While they're taking their place, I would like to point out that the information that's in the packet that Ms. Call referred us to speaks to an issue that I raised yesterday, which is the budget offsets, that when we look only at the cost side and we're not looking at the offsets, that it's really not a true cost picture for Ways and Means Committee to get. So I'm going to study it some more.
Okay, thank you. Welcome. Go ahead and start and introduce yourself for the record, please.
My name is Robin Thompson, and I am from Corvallis, Oregon. I'm the mom of a daughter. Her name is Mackenzie Thompson. She was born with Aicardi syndrome, and she actually passed away 3 months ago.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. I wanted to come and talk to you, not because it's any benefit to myself or anything, but because my heart is so, I want it so much for all the other families that are in the state of Oregon and stuff. Every year we had to choose, you know, when raises came around, we had to decide, is this something that we can do? Because if we do and we go over the income bracket, we would lose all of her medical benefits, and we would be placed in a situation that seemed would be incredibly hard to be able to dig ourselves out of. And there is no success in the workplace that can compensate for the success in the home. And there's no amount of money that you could ever earn that would take the place of the love that you earn from having a child in your home. They bring so much into our lives and to the lives of their siblings as well. She had hanging on her wall a poster that was made by siblings and stuff, and it's kind of hard to see, but it said home sweet home. And so the pictures that we've included on the handout are to depict what our home sweet home looked like. And every child should be entitled to a home sweet home. Every child should be able to go on picnics with the family. Every child should be allowed to go swimming with siblings and to go on vacations. And every child should have kisses from dad and hugs from mom and siblings to gather around and hug them. And I can't imagine having to be put in a situation where that would be taken from me, and that if I couldn't support my child, they would have to be placed in a home. And sorry,
it's okay.
It is amazing how quiet a home can be when you lose a child who never said a word, never held a toy, never said, I love you, and couldn't do all the things that so many other children do. And it is my hope that other families would never have to put their children in a home just because of financial restrictions. And thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Hello. My name is Jimmy Smith. I live at Dunaway House in an apartment with another roommate. I get service from Charlotte. Have been with them about 16 years. I want you to know how important my staff is. My staff help me with things like take me to church and going with me to the doctors, that they take me on trips, help me get my apartment, and give me my medicine every day. My staff are very nice. They do very good job, and means a lot to me. Some staff only stay for a short time, but sometimes they stay for a long time. Sometimes they leave to get another job. It is very hard when I leave because they mean so much to me. I wish that they don't not have to leave because I will miss them.
Thank you, Jim. Thanks. Alex, did you want to testify? And give your name for the record, please.
Okay. Thanks. Madam Chair and the members of the committee, my name is Alex Thompson. I live in Corvallis, Oregon. I live with my mom, dad, two brothers, and a sister. My other sister, Lindsay, recently passed away. She was disabled, and with that disability, there was many medical and financial requirements that we were assisted with. And one night I heard my parents talking about my dad getting a raise, and the conversation soon turned to whether he could accept this raise, because in accepting the raise, would it push them beyond the financial maximum to qualify for the benefits. And I can't remember whether he could accept the raise or not in the end, but it just struck me and stuck in my mind, and I wanted to come today and testify that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm Gordon Teifel, and this is my youngest son, Barrick Teifel. He's a non-speaker. He needs help with all living skills. If his IQ is hard to measure because it's so low, his EQ is extremely high. You saw him sit on my lap. He's highly qualified at a skill of being a Laplander. The good news is that throughout schooling, he had early intervention from the age of 2 months until he was 21 years old and aged out of school. Of his 6 years in high school, at the end of his first year at Westview High, they said, "We're going to redistrict you, send you to Aloha High." And I said, "No, because it takes half a year to figure him out, to know what he needs." And that same parallel comes here with higher pay for caregivers in this comprehensive services budget. He needs stable help. He's lived 24 years in our unlicensed group home. Our family home, yes. This helps us cope because until we become broken in some way, he is thriving, he's flourishing because he has help from the brokerage services. But he won't get into a comprehensive group home until I can't lift him anymore. And certainly my wife, who weighs 30 pounds less than me, cannot lift him off the floor. She is very challenged by lifting him. So I speak very strongly in favor of raising the pay to have stable staff for folks like Barrick in group homes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Questions?
No? Thanks very much. And while you are shifting here, we'll have Senator Devlin. I was thinking Richard, but I didn't want to call you Richard. And then we will have our final panel come up. Welcome, Senator Devlin. I missed the Devlin. I got the Richard.
Well, it's often shortened to Devil, so.
Devil. I've always called you Richard. Well, welcome. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. I've been asked to come here to speak today on behalf of the developmental disability community. And I know actually many of you on the dais are actually more qualified than I am. I've commonly talked to them about an issue that Senator Morris and I have spent considerable time talking about. We are all aware, and I think you've heard it already here today, and I'll try not to take too much time, about the crisis that in the developmentally disability comprehensive system. We understand the magnitude of the issues that they face and the fact that they're responsible for the health and safety and livelihoods of over probably thousands of people, and we literally have thousands of workers in this area. Workers, many of which make little above minimum wage. We also understand, I think, that we, like in many areas, which many of us have to talk about, that the state has not kept their commitment. Their commitment to these workers and the commitment to the people that they care for. There are many explanations for that. And to be quite honestly, explanations don't solve problems. Explanations just explain them. I'm speaking a little bit extemporaneously here and going away from the prepared comments because I think some of the people that you have here are probably far better at testifying about this than I am. But one of the things I wanted to talk about is these are commitments that, you know, were both made back in 1989. They were made again in 1999 when we closed the Fairview Center about the resources that we would devote. And we all know that there's a request in for $60 million for developmentally disabled, largely to meet some of the payroll needs that they have, to increase the wages to reasonable levels, and to provide a reasonable set of benefits. Quite honestly, even with the increases, not wages that many of us would ever choose to do this type of work for. I mean, even with this full increase, people would be making a little bit more than $11 an hour with reasonably decent benefits. And that's almost a 50% increase for many people. So you can imagine what they're doing this work for now. many of us here on, both you on the committee and many legislators have visited particularly developmentally disabled homes. And you realize the type of work that people face in doing this work every day. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I've been asked to make the most compelling case that I can to you about this need. And I know that the governor went so far. And I know that the co-chairs, I'll give the co-chairs a little credit here, the co-chairs went a little bit farther than the governor. What I'm asking you here today to do is to go a little bit farther. Now, I think the advocates behind me would like me to ask you for the total $60 million. I happen to know some of the realities of the budget, and I know that serving on two other subcommittees, I often have people that come to me and ask for more money for this or more money for that. In fact, some of the members of the committee have come to me and asked for more money for this or more money for that. But I would tell you that as you look at your needs, and your needs are great in human services, they are as important as any of the other needs that we have in this building, whether they're in education or public safety, or even in one of my subcommittees in trying to protect our environment or trying to preserve our natural resources for Oregonians' future, that you consider this area perhaps one of the most deserving. I know that you deal with issues in terms of compensation levels. I know that hospitals are undercompensated. I know that physicians are undercompensated. I know that a lot of people in the system are undercompensated. But the people that actually perform these services are amongst the most poorly compensated. I think they should be first on your list. They may not have as, well, they may not have as many members of the lobby. They may not have the people to do all the studies that to show what their costs are. But I think each one of you clearly knows the needs that are there. And if you can find the dollars, I can tell you this is one senator that will not complain that that's where you've chosen to put them. And I'll just leave it at that, Madam Chair. And thank you for this opportunity.
Well, thank you. Senator, I think that's the most I've ever heard you say in one time. So I'm really happy.
You haven't been in committee. You have not been in talk. Richard, no.
He's such a man of few words when he says anything I listen. So thank you for coming.
I'll hear that for you.
What I would like to know, because you have spoken compellingly and eloquently, as you always do, Senator, have you communicated the same message to the co-chairs of Ways and Means?
Yes, I have. But I will do it again.
Thank you.
And again.
Thank you. And again. Thank you. We have the last panel. And thanks so much for coming. Appreciate it. Mary Ellen Cole. But didn't Mary Ellen's already spoken? She's on. Okay. Leanne Riley. We might have multiple. Leanne Riley. I have Carla, no last name. Brett, no last name. And Mark. Correct. So please come forward and I apologize, we've gone a little bit over, but it's Chair's priority. Yes. Welcome. Go ahead and
chair. Shall I go?
Yeah, why don't you? Please.
Well, Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for your time. My name is Brent Watkins, and I represent Partnerships in Community Living, 450 employees that provide services to people with developmental disabilities in Polk, Marion, Benton, and Linn counties. I think the landscape has been fairly effectively established here today, so I'll just briefly give you a profile of one of our employees. An employee that works for PCL, that has worked for us for the first year, makes on average about $1,200 a month after taxes. Now, we actually supplement health care for our employees. But even in supplementing health care, our employees, if they're to provide insurance for their family, pay over $500 a month. So you can do the math there. If I make $1,200 and $500 is just going to health care, there's not much money left to provide for my family. So just briefly, the jobs that that people are doing are physically and emotionally demanding. People are dealing with some of the most intensive health care or behavioral and health support needs. Some of our employees have told me they would rather work fast food than put up with the demand of the job that they have to do. So what does that mean? It means that some of our employees are some of the heaviest users of state welfare programs. Some of our employees are putting their children at risk for ongoing illness and pain because they can't afford health benefits. It means people with disabilities, some of Oregon's most vulnerable citizens, are at higher risk of negligent care because of constant turnover that occurs. And finally, it means that we have a system that is grossly underfunded when people prioritize serving hamburgers over serving people. And if I might just conclude by saying that as I've sat here today, I've observed great compassion from members of this committee, and I have great confidence that, you'll do everything you can to fund our request. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yes, members of the panel, Senator Wilson and Senator Bates and Senator Morsi, unemployment in this state for people with disabilities is 7%.
Can you please give us your name?
Mark Kinnick is my name, and I am the co-chair of the ISN, which is an integrated services network of Marion County through the Catholic Community Services. And I have a few handouts that I gave the gentleman. I didn't have enough for everybody, but I do have an article here from the April 18th paper. It says, Clarifin State Rules Puts Man in Fix. And I will pass that article down to you, and you can look at it, and you can make other copies. But the point that I'm going to make here, we have one set of health rules for these people, and one for foster care people. Now, we cannot have double jeopardy here. And another thing, too, the double jeopardy has got to stop, because we're penalized for one thing. All right, for an example, I get they raise my housing $6. I lose $6 in food stamps. So I mean, somewhere that this has got to stop. Now President Bush wants to cut the food stamp program by 1%. I don't know if you people have heard that or know that, but I heard that the other day. Now I don't know for sure, but it's just nonstop here. I mean, it's. I don't know how much more the federal government is going to take out on the less fortunate and the poor here, but I hope that I have made my point, and I've been down to the health care meetings with Senator Bates and Senator Morsi and different ones, and so I hope that I have made my point. But thank you for hearing.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thanks.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Leanne Riles, and I'm here kind of wearing the double hat here. I am also a family caregiver, and I also coordinate the Lifespan Respite Care Network for Marion and Polk Counties. And this is not regarding the actual DD bill that we're talking about today, but it has a direct impact on everybody that was in this family today and probably all the testimony that you've heard in the last couple weeks. Because respite care is kind of the behind-the-scenes support system for everybody that's been in this room today that has testified and all the testimonies that you've heard in the past. We're behind the scenes. We not only help the family caregivers get a break once in a while, and it can be professional caregivers. It also can be foster care, whether they're taking care of children and or adults. So we're kind of behind the scenes. But we not only help them with respite resources, we also do caregiver classes to empower caregivers to take care of themselves. Because if they're not healthy or they have health issues, there's not going to be anybody there for, you know, the ones that they love that they're taking care of. So I realize you don't have a copy of Senate Bill 648 in front of you, but we've been trying to testify to get some funding reattached to this bill. The original House Bill 2013 was passed in 1997 to support family caregivers. And so we are trying to revise that bill. We need to get some additional dollars into the fund because we've had a 12% cut from the state to our statewide lifespan program. We've also had cuts from the AAA's for those programs. So, you know, we're a statewide, we're a nationwide model, and I'm hoping that we can continue to do that by supporting families. So we're asking, giving you copies of each county breakout for lifespan respite dollars. As you can see, there's not very much there. So we're asking this committee, and again, I agree with this gentleman here that you're a very compassionate committee here today, to restore the 12% cuts that we've had this last year, and perhaps add maybe double what we've already got, because you can see we're operating on a very slim budget. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And you are not just behind the scenes. You guys are the true angels.
My name is Carla Cudmore. I'm from Polk County, and I'm here to talk in favor of the DD Comprehensive Services budgets. My daughter, Kaylin, is 20 years old, but functions at the 12 to 18-month-old level. She can't walk or talk. She can't feed herself or use a bathroom. She requires extensive lifting, has limited use of her arms, grand mal seizures, and can't be left alone. We love her dearly, but she requires a great deal of time, patience, and strength. Kaylin lives with us at home, and we hope she will for a long, long time. But how long are we going to be able to take care of her? Kaylin will have a day program of 4 or 5 hours a day. There are, however, many hours in each day and each week, and Kaylin must be cared for every single one of them. That's our job, her father and I. But we're going to wear out, and we're going to die. The lifting, the lack of sleep, the stress, depression. Parents of disabled children age faster than our counterparts. And this doesn't even take into consideration the extra stress and heartaches, but also being the caretaker of an aging parent who is legally blind with dementia takes. What will happen to our daughter when we can't take care of her any longer? Kaylin we placed through crisis with no planning into a 24-hour residential care system in the state wherever there's an empty bed. Long-term crisis management does not work. It's not fiscally sound, and that's what's currently being done. The system must change so that parents like me are allowed to work together with the state and county to transition our children into 24-hour care rather than waiting for the crisis to occur. We want to be involved. There are many of us, the baby boomers, with our severely disabled children at home. We need help. The state of Oregon and the Department of Human Services must begin planning for a non-crisis, truly comprehensive approach for adults with developmental disabilities who require 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week care. Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions? Comments? Senator Westman.
Couple comments. The first is I kind of want to tie Representative Nathanson, who I'm sure had to leave to go testify on one of her bills. It's that time of session. We're in and out. So, but I kind of want to tie Representative Nathanson's excellent comment with regard to the cost-effectiveness of rate reimbursement to where I think Jan Kroll was trying to go with her excellent presentation that she's presented. And what it functionally says and what Jan was trying to get at was here is the evidence that this is a cost-effective, you know, investment for the state. And that there's a critical time element to when these funds or the increases are first are funded. It's one thing, you know, to fund something on the last day of the biennium and say, oh, you know, great, look what we did. We did all these increased reimbursement rates, but it's of little to no use for the people, the providers that most desperately need it now. So I kind of wanted to tie Representative Nathanson and Jan Kroll's comments together. But having said that, I want to point this out to everyone, and this is not, don't misinterpret these words. You have very nobly and articulated, you know, a pressing crisis need. Thank you, because that does make our jobs, as difficult as they are, easier. But here's, let's put this in a big perspective. You know, here's where this state is. I mean, everyone's saying, oh my gosh, you got plenty of money, you just got 20% more revenue this biennium than last. And nobody asked the question, 20% from what? And those were depression-level fundings from the 03 biennium. Depression level. So it's like you're a two-income household and both of you lost your jobs, and then one comes back with a minimum wage job. Yeah, percentage-wise, you're up a ton, but you still can't support or sustain the state's investment in critical services. This is from yours to K-12 to community colleges to higher ed to drug and alcohol. We have the 47th lowest tax rate in this country. So when we fund, you know, our judges 50th out of 50, when our community colleges are funded at 43rd out of 50, our drug and alcohol per capita, you know, is 37th out of 50, you know what? We are right in line with what our funding allows. And even that funding is not sustainable because Oregon has the most volatile revenue structure in America. And in this last recession, Oregon's revenues fell further and faster than any state in the nation. Think about that. That's what the 20% bounce is from. So this is not just an issue of adequacy of funding, it's an issue of stability of funding. When you talk about how low our revenue rates truly are, if you took Idaho's tax structure, that bastion of liberal thought, you took Idaho's tax structure, moved it a couple 300 miles west and plunked it down on Oregon, we would be producing an additional $1.2 billion a biennium more. This state needs fundamental and systemic fiscal reform. Push a magic button, and I'm not saying this is going to happen. Push a magic button. We get you the $60 million, we get it tomorrow. It's not sustainable. Either in the way we deliver our health care services through our Medicaid programs or your funding streams, or how we provide revenue to any of the other absolutely vital public services that this state funds, from K-12 to higher ed to our judiciary. It's not sustainable. And what happens session after session is we all come in here. There's not a person on this committee that does not want to fund the $60 million. Not one. But we and you come in and fight for an ever increasingly smaller piece, you know, smaller slice of literally an increasingly shrinking pie. That has got to stop in Oregon, or Oregon will no longer remain the state we're all so proud to call home. This is not just an issue about DD funding. This is, pick any silo you want, K-12, higher ed, indigent defense. Pick any issue. There are passionate advocates throughout this building, throughout this state, for all of those and all the others. All 90 line items in our budgets. This is a call to action, not just for us, but for all of you. If you want Oregon to remain Oregon, we have got to address how we deliver health care services and how we fairly raise more revenue in this state. I'm sorry I went off on my soapbox, Madam Chair, but it's a critical issue. I appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Yes, Madam Chair, if I could just add on to my colleague's statement, because I feel that what he has shared with us is that there's light at the end of the tunnel, but we've got to go there to see it. And there is that opportunity to go there in this session, and that is the House Bill 2530 that Senator Morse referenced at the very beginning of our hearing today. And so I would ask all of you, just as all of us, will be looking forward to participating in those hearings. There will be more than one. It's an opportunity to look at and talk seriously about short and long-term fiscal reform, tax reform, revenue reform, however you want to frame it. We can claim that opportunity in this session. There is light at the tunnel, at the end of the tunnel. There is light at the end of the tunnel. The other thing I want to say to us, Madam Chair, and this is something that has struck me as we've heard the public testimony. Over the years, and this is my 16th year of service, I've had colleagues, some who are no longer serving, some who are currently serving, say to me, you know, I just don't want to have that human services subcommittee assignment. I know I can't handle it. Well, you know what? If I could wave a wand, I would make sure that every legislator, all 90 of us, had exposure to this information in this kind of forum, so that the information comes to our, not just our head, but to our hearts. To our hearts, those of us who have the privilege of serving on this subcommittee, in my view, are exposed to the angels. We are the angels in this room, but also human potential. All that the best that we can be, the very best that we can be, when we are looking out for each other. So I say that for the good of the order, and again, I join my colleague, Senator Westland, in the call. There is light at the end of the tunnel, but we've got to go there to see it, and so let's go together. Hearing room A will be the place where those hearings take place. And we've got to connect the discussions that take place here in Hearing Room F, which are about the needs, to what goes on in Hearing Room A, which is about the revenue. We've got to make that connection, and we can do that in this session.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Bates?
I know we're way over. This will be very quick. First, I want to thank you for coming today, and I tell you, I don't know how you have the courage, strength to do what you do, day after day, taking care of your family members the way you do. I think I work hard. Just forget it. I'm going to have to stop whining immediately. I don't know how you do it. And I'm going to add on to what good Senator Westland said and what Senator Moore said beginning of the meeting about revenue in this state. It's not only what he said, but that we're in a death spiral. The $60 million you're talking about is really $140 million because there's federal match involved. And there's money coming back to state on income taxes from that. And there's even more involved in that, in this death spiral, for your budget and for every other budget we looked at this way. And if you fail, if you can't handle this anymore, and those individuals end up in group homes and up in nursing homes, the cost goes exponentially up. So we're in a double death spiral here, and we've got to reverse this, and we've got to move forward with revenue change. We do need $1 billion more than this budget. We honestly do. It's budget after budget after budget of need that is absolutely real. Not just, I think I like to have it, it's absolutely real. So thank you for coming.
And I am in so much hot water now because this room needs to turn over to the next committee, but I want to thank everybody who came. And I guess you always have to have someone to blame, so we can thank and blame Sarah Gelser, Representative Gelser, for kind of spiraling us out into these other related areas. And I appreciate the comments of the senators, and thank you again for everything you do. You stand adjourned.